Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. What is the proper role for the states to support public education throughout Vermont? In recent years, we've seen a number of towns close their public schools and then tuition their students to a new private school in town or other public schools in the region. Does this approach make sense? And there's also a big debate about the overall way that Vermont finances public education and whether or not a program known as income sensitivity, that's a program that allows homeowners with household incomes under roughly $95,000 to pay their school taxes based on their income and not the value of the property. Is this program leading to higher school budgets? Economist Dick Heap says people who participate in this program definitely vote for higher school budgets. But House Education Chair Johanna Donovan says that theory is nonsense.
And in effect, from an economist standpoint, what you've done is you've put education on sale. And when you cut a price of something, you spend more. And I think that's what happens when we get to our towns. Most of the voters in town are protected from the full impact of that increase in the budget, so they vote to increase the budget. It sounds like a good idea.
When they vote yes, they're very aware that the percentage of income they pay is going to rise. So I'm a little bit struck that this has become part of a public discussion because there is no one who has a bit of evidence to support that statement.
Today in the program, we're going to explore all of these issues with our guests, Rob Roper, who's the president of the Ethan Allen Institute, and Paul Cielo, who is the president of the Public Assets Institute. Great to have you here.
Thanks very much for having us.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you think is the proper role for the state to fund education? Should towns be allowed to close their local public schools and then replace it with a private school? And should parents be able to take advantage of school choice in every community in Vermont? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or just give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So before we start our discussion on public education, let's let our listeners know a little more about your organizations. Rob Roper, what's the Ethan Allen Institute?
Well, the Ethan Allen Institute is Vermont's free market-oriented think tank. We've been around since 1993, and basically we follow what's happening down at the State House, try to provide a little bit of transparency, let people know what's going on under the Golden Dome and with policy throughout the state, and we provide free market-oriented solutions for the problems that we face.
Paul, tell us about the Public Assets Institute.
Public Assets Institute is we analyze state tax budget and economic policy from the perspective of ordinary Vermonters. And we our offices are here in Montpelier. This is our 10th year that we've been doing this work. And we publish our work on our website at publicassets.org.
All right. Currently in Vermont, I think there are about 93 towns that don't operate their own schools, and instead taxpayers pay the tuition for these students to go to a public or a private school. Rob Roper, do you like this program?
I think it's terrific. I mean, it's existed in Vermont for about 150 years. If you look at the places where there are clusters of these tuitioning towns that have this up in the Northeast Kingdom and down in the southern part of the state primarily, you look at the schools and the quality of education that's grown up around this system. You've got St. Johnsbury Academy, the Linden Institute sort of anchoring this very vibrant and diverse group of independent schools in the Northeast Kingdom. You have Byrne Burton Academy. The Thetford Academy in the southern part of the state as the anchors. But then you also have schools like the Sharon Academy, the Long Trail School, the Mountain School at Windhall, the one that went was a public school that turned independent about 15 years ago. Most recently, you have the Village School of North Bennington that went independent just this past year. The diversity of opportunity for the kids who live in and around those communities is phenomenal, and they're scoring well. The parents are satisfied. It's terrific. We should have more of it.
And under that system, a parent could choose a private school anywhere in Vermont or even outside Vermont,
or even outside. Yeah, part of the debate series that Paul and I have been having around the state, I've also been talking to parents who are part of these communities. And you listen to like one parent in the Northeast Kingdom says, well, I've got three kids. One kid ended up going to St. Johnsbury Academy because she was interested in a nursing program, and they had a great nursing program. My son, on the other hand, went to the Lyndon Institute because he was interested in music, and they had a great music program. You know, the other opportunities they have were the local public schools. There were a couple other smaller independent schools. There was another public school in New Hampshire. And these families were able to sit down with their kids and figure out which school was the best fit for that kid. And in doing so, each kid was able to find an environment in which he or she thrived. It's a wonderful system.
Paul, what do you think about that system?
Well, I think I don't have any problem with the existing towns that tuition their kids to public or private schools. The issue, though, is because, first of all, it's a very small – it's 93 towns, but it's a very small percentage of the children who are publicly educated in Vermont. Fewer than 4% of the children are in those 93 towns that go to private school. But the issue is going forward – that are we going to continue to have public schools, or are we going to be converting public schools to do more of this, essentially privatizing public schools? And what I'd want to point out is that it's really public schools that have produced the excellent results that Vermont has gotten. Vermont ranks in the top 5 in test scores nationally, and we're usually number 1 in terms of high school graduation rates in the nation. And it's, you know, more than 96% of the children in Vermont schools are in public schools, and it's a tribute to public schools that we actually have done as well as we have. That in the mid-20th century, the graduation rates were typically about 50%, and that it's public schools that have moved the state from these low graduation rates to well over 90%. So it's – I think we don't want to – we're talking about a system, and – as a system, public schools really serve all the children of the state very well.
So you're concerned we see a couple of towns closing their public schools and essentially a private school is coming in its place. You're worried about this trend.
Well, I think that what's happened is that the national agenda to privatize schools is using this, as Rob mentioned, this 150-year-old tradition in Vermont to essentially close public schools and convert to private schools. And I think that's not a direction that's going to serve the children of the state of Vermont. And I'm all the children. I mean, we can hear anecdotes about individual children that have done better in this school or that school. But I think what we need to think about is when we're talking about system change is how are we doing serving all the children of the state and not leaving kids out.
Today in the program, we're looking at the state's role in education. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about this? Let's talk to Steve in Ferrisburg. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. So I guess in our mad rush toward increasing inequality, income inequality, we have a very competitive society and we tend to leave other people behind. So my concern and what I think the role of the state is to ensure equality of opportunity, not just so that the excellent can excel, but also so that the regular people can make a good life, have a good education, and make a good life. So, for example, I think it's really important for there to be diversity in the classroom. If you have students leaving a school to go pursue an education in a different school because it's better, then does that mean that some of the schools end up with a less diverse classroom where the regular students don't get exposure to the really excellent students? That's a consideration and an example. But again, my point is I'm looking for equality of opportunity for everybody.
All right, Steve. Paul Cielo, that was the Brigham decision, wasn't it, for the most part?
That is. Essentially, that was the point of the court looking at the Equal Protection Clause of the Vermont Constitution and saying that what we want to do is ensure that all children have access to education and that the resources to support that are available in all communities in the state. So I I agree with Steve that when we look at a system, that we want a system that provides equality of opportunity. We want to have diverse classrooms, and we want to make sure that that we don't leave children behind. And that's what public schools do, is that they essentially are obligated to take all the children who live in that community and provide public education for them.
Rob, we got this email.
Well, actually, could I address Steve's points?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Steve, I agree with most of what you said, but the fact of the matter is, when you talk about income inequality, all wealthy children have school choice because their parents can either afford to send them to a private school that's going to better suit their needs, or they can move to a community where there is – you know, where there's a better school, and it's going to tend to have, you know, higher property values, higher property taxes, and you have to pay more for the house to begin with. I agree with you, equal opportunity is important, but equal opportunity to find the school that's right for you. If you're a kid and you're put into a classroom and you're not learning for whatever reason, if you don't have the opportunity to move on, you don't have an equal opportunity to the kid who's sitting next to you where that is the right environment for them. Right now, a lot of kids are falling through the cracks because it's a one-size-fits-all system. And even though Vermont does very well as we stack up nationally, a lot of the kids who are graduating from high school are graduating less than proficient according to our NECAP scores. If you're graduating but you're not learning, we're doing something wrong. And I think that the system that we have actually creates a lot more diversity in the classroom. Studies have shown that that students or schools that have students that have access to vouchers are actually more diverse because we're, you know, if you look at what happens in the public school silos that we have today, you have wealthy communities where all the wealthy people move into the communities for the school. The poor people are left behind and they are segregated in their classrooms based on their income because of the school system that we have.
So we got this email from Jack who says, for those people who are supporting school choice, what about the question of transportation? How can a family that has a single car that's necessary to transport to and from work have effective school choice? What about that issue?
You're looking at me, so
yes. Yeah. I mean,
so I'll answer
because you're saying, you know, here's a family with three students, and one can go here, and one can go there, and one can go over there. Well, how do you get the students to all these places if you don't have transportation?
But they do. They get around. I mean, we've had the system in place in the southern part of the state for 150 years, in the northern part of the state for 150 years, and you don't see stories in the news about little Johnny can't get to school. There are very creative solutions for getting kids to school. First, parents who really want their kid to take part in a program are going to find a way to get the kid there. And when the money's following the child, you know, as much as $13,000 per year following the child, the school has a pretty powerful incentive to make sure that they can get kid from point A to point B because it's in their interest to do so. I've seen lots of creative solutions from parent carpooling and use of public transportation, use of school buses and creating partnerships with public schools. There are lots of ways to get kids from point A to point B. What I would say is, you know, would you be able to find a situation where it's just impossible for this kid to get to that school? I'm sure you do. But you have to weigh that next to the morality of telling a kid who would be better off in a school that's a mile away that you cannot go there, even though it's going to be a better fit for you because we've drawn a line and you're going to stay where you are.
First of all, I should remind everybody who's listening that we do have public school choice in Vermont for grades 9 through 12. In other words, that's something that public school districts to do a lot, and the reason for it is along the lines of what Rob has said, to provide options for kids within the public school system. I think what Rob assumes is that what you need to do is abandon the public schools or somehow shut down the public schools in order to provide this choice for these children that may not be suited to a particular school. And I would argue that that's not the solution, that it's really throwing out the baby with the bathwater when you shut down the whole school system in a community for the sake of, you know, having, you know, a couple of kids that need something different. So I think that back to the transportation question, I think transportation is a major issue when it comes to privatization and choice. That it puts a few parents that actually might want to transport their child to a school outside of the community, that it puts all the parents in that community in that situation. And I think that makes it untenable for many, many parents.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Anne in Burlington. Hi, Anne. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm concerned about the what they say 15 to 17% of the learning disabled school general population. And my experience as a mother of a learning disabled child and a teacher at the Pine Ridge School leads me to suspect all the good intentions of the public school systems in teaching this very, very bright population of individuals and, you know, who are discriminated against unintentionally even by the school systems that they're in. Too many educators feel that learning disabled equals stupid and unteachable. I'm concerned, what are the statistics on the success of the LD population graduating from the public schools? I would be curious to know that.
All right. Do either of you know that?
No, I'd be curious to know it, too. But I will tell you a great story that I heard up in the Northeast Kingdom about special education students and school choice. And this was from a special education certified teacher who teaches in the prison system. And he's dealing with kids who are severely disadvantaged. And he came to the conclusion that they actually have less cost and less need for special education in his school district in the Kirby area. Because of school choice, kids are not needing special education services because they're finding the school where they can thrive. And a lot of the time, that's an independent school. And because they are thriving, there's no need for the special education service.
Today on the program, we're looking at the proper role for the state in funding education. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. We're looking at the role of government in education. Our guest today, Rob Roper, the president of the Ethan Allen Institute, and Paul Cielo, the president of Public Assets Institute. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Howie in Windham. Hi, Howie. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you? Very interesting topic you guys bring up here. My question is, if we go to a system of vouchers, how does that help the average Vermonter? For instance, if I wanted to send my kid to Putney School or Vermont Academy, the tuition there is like $38,000. If I get a $13,000 voucher, that's not going to allow me to send my kid to that school. It's going to help a wealthy person. It's going to give them a discount on the tuition, and it's great for them. But most Vermonters cannot afford to add $20,000 to a voucher to send their kid to the school that they want to. I also wanted to bring up one of your speakers there mentions the town of Windhall, which closed their public school. That's a big second homeowner community. One of the biggest problems they have there now are second homeowners claiming residence so they can get a voucher and send their kid to a private school. You know, we have a great public education system here, and I think our public dollars need to go into funding that.
All right. Rob Roper, what about Howie's concerns? $13,000 might work to go to another public school in Vermont, but some of these private schools have pretty hefty tuitions.
Actually, some of the public schools have pretty hefty tuitions as well that are beyond the statewide average. He's correct, and I actually think that that's a problem in the system. I think that one of the restrictions we might want to look at is sending the vouchers to schools that charge more than that voucher amount. But most of the schools do charge the statewide average. The Mountain School at Windhall charges the statewide average. The Sharon Academy charges the statewide average. Most of the schools charge that, you know, I think it's around $13,000 a year this year is what they charge. As for the problem that he mentioned about Windhall and the second homeowners, that was a problem for that community when they first went independent. However, I think that they've addressed that locally by looking very strictly at how people are determined whether they're residents of the state or not. So it is a concern. It was something that they had to deal with, and as far as I've learned from talking to people in that community, they have dealt with it.
Paul Cielo, we got this email from Darlene in North Springfield who wrote, "School choice shouldn't depend on where you live. Why shouldn't we be able to choose another school that would be a better fit for a child, especially in the elementary and middle school years? which are critical for the development of any child. Darlene thinks everybody ought to have school choice.
Well, the reason – there's two ways essentially that we can – that people can get choice. One is to do what Rob is wanting people to do, which is to close public schools. And this is – this doesn't require legislation at this point. In other words, school districts can close their public school and then everybody in that community or every child that in that community then needs to be educated in a school that – some other school because there is no longer a public school there. The another proposal that's been floated around over the years is the idea of offering school choice and having money follow the student from existing school districts. The problem with that is that it actually takes money from the operation of the public school and leaves the public school with inadequate resources to actually operate. So essentially you're diluting the resources of that community and making it impossible, really, for a school district or a public school to function. And I should add that one of the main reasons that public schools offer is that they are publicly owned, they're democratically controlled, the budgets are public information, that you actually get to vote on the budget. I mean, these are all things that you don't do with private schools. Private schools do not make their budgets publicly available. You don't get to elect the school board that makes the decision about hiring the principal and the teachers. You don't get to see the budgets in advance. So I think there's when a community decides to close its public school, it's really, as we've been saying in these debates, it's the last democratic decision that they'll be making in that community on education.
Let's go back and talk to John in Peru. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring up the issue of community. It's something that I think often gets overlooked in the discussions, and I live down in Peru, right next to Wynn Hall, where this is an ongoing conversation. And we're a school choice town for high school. But the issue that I have is that when schools evoke school choice, what happens is schools that have traditionally played a big role in developing and fostering community in the towns are then broken apart. When we have families that are sending students to different places, like goes on in Wynn Hall right now, where only about half the students in Wynn Hall attend the Mountain School in Wynn Hall. Essentially, you create sort of divergent communities in the town. And the interaction that they have always traditionally had because of the schools they send their kids to sort of goes away. And I think that's even more... it's sort of exacerbated in Wynn Hall by the fact that there's been some animosity over the years that Wynn Hall funds different schools differently. So they've elected to fund the Mountain School at one level and fund other schools at another level. And so families sending their students to different schools have sort of come to, argue about these tuition levels over the years.
All right, John, thanks for your phone call. Rob, what about this loss of communities? Because in many towns, the public school is really the center of the community.
Well, I think that it's certainly different. It's a different dynamic. But in fact, I think that when you have independent schools, you're actually fostering stronger communities because it forces people to come together and make the decisions on how they're going to raise their children. I mean, the parents who are working in an independent school, generally they have to do a little fundraising on the side. There's the transportation issue. You have to coordinate with your parents about how you're going to get your kids to school. The parents actually have a lot more decision-making power in the school because they have the opportunity to vote with their feet. And that fosters very strong communities focused on education and how to educate the children. Is it different from a community that has a public school? Yes, it's a different type of community. I think it's a stronger one, and we can have different opinions about which is better.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Hunter in Peacham. Hi, Hunter. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi there.
I've got a question regarding, is there do you find that there's a brain drain phenomenon going on with school-age children in Vermont that is, kids whose families have the means to be sending them out of state because they can't find what they need in the state? And if there is, in fact, such a phenomenon going on, what impact do you think it'll have on the Vermont workforce?
All right, Hunter. Paul Cielo, did you say for the 93 towns that currently have school choice, that just represents something like 4% of the student population?
It represents 4% of the total student population that are attending public the private schools. In other words, there's only about 4% of the children in the state that are going to private schools with public funding in these choice towns.
Yeah. All right.
So there are other children in those 93 towns that are going to public schools. But in terms of the ones going to private schools, it's less than 4%.
Yeah, the total voucher population is about 6%, I think, and 4% go to the private school.
All right. That's a good thing to clear up. Let's talk to John in Richmond. Hi, John. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, it seems periodically we cover, when we talk about education, we always talk about funding first. Obviously, taxes get everybody's attention. But we should be at least concurrently be talking about the other measures for success. How do we evaluate what our end product is, our students coming out of the school system? Are we evaluating that at all? Are we tracking that at all? How are we tracking, the development of curriculum, of teachers, of, what are the goals that we can agree on? If you go to buy a car, you at least have an idea of a model, make, power, reliability. There's many factors that you're looking at. What our discussion tends to boil down to is a couple of things, and it always taxes is always becomes the focal point, discarding somewhat whether there's a short-term gain in quality or a long-term gain in quality. Because we come up with a new funding regime every 5 to 10 years, and nobody seems to go back to look what the success of the previous one was. We're always just coming up with something new and then say, oh, this is the latest and greatest. I would encourage collaboration here. And it's not a win-lose, it's not a zero-sum game, but you've got to look at a combination of these factors. Otherwise, the system's going to collapse under the weight of too many cooks.
All right, John. Rob, do you think that John has a point that we need better educational quality standards?
Well, we need better educational quality. I took a little bit of an exception to his comment that nobody talks about or everybody talks about the dollars first, when the first thing I brought up was that this is about having kids find the proper environment for them to thrive. That should be the goal of education, is finding an opportunity to thrive, to give everybody the intellectual tools that they need to succeed in life and as a member of our society. I think what you'll find in the independent school model is you'll have and it's a good that John brought up the example of a car. When you go to figure out what car you want, you don't have it's not the days of the Model T where you can have whatever color you want as long as it's black. You have to figure out, do you have a big family? Do you have a small family? Are you using it for long trips? Are you using it for work? Are you using it to commute? And you can then choose the car that best suits your need. We should have the same thing for education. It's more efficient for a family, for the purchaser of that car, to have all those choices. Maybe less efficient for the manufacturer of the car, because they have to figure out what people want. But it should be about efficiency for the family and efficiency for the kid, and the adults in the room should come second.
Paul?
I was interested in John's comment about encouraging collaboration. And I think the best way to have collaboration is to actually keep public schools as the center of communities. The previous caller was talking about how communities change or we lose something when we close public schools. And I think that's true, that for many communities in the state, the community public school is the community center where people come together and collaboratively work through and solve problems.
Rob, help me understand something. Let's say I'm in one of the 93 tuitioning towns, and let's say I want to send my child to St. Johnsbury Academy. Does that child have to get accepted by St. J. Academy? Is there an application process, or is it automatic?
I believe for St. Johnsbury Academy, it's automatic if you're in a certain number of towns. There are certain towns that have decided that they will they have an agreement with the academy. And it's mm-hmm. the same at the Mountain School at Windhall. They take every kid that lives in that town. It's part of the agreement that they have in order for the voters to approve the tuition rates. I think if you're not in one of those towns, then yes, you do have to apply.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Morris in Benson. Hi, Morris. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I was wondering of the perspective of the panel on the idea that Vermont has set up a system in which it is the role of the state to provide a public education, yet it has divided it up into a series of town schools and town school districts, and the quality can vary widely depending upon the community and the interests of the community, and as a consequence, students in one town might have a great school, students in another town might not. And one alternative that I never hear discussed is the idea that maybe we should have a statewide system. And that could still have some kind of choice in which there were schools of different types that all students could participate in. But right now, we've created a set of standards in order to try and equalize the education around the schools and a set of supervisory unions in order to administer the program. And this has layered a lot of administrative cost that doesn't go directly to students. And so I'm wondering, if it is the role of the state to educate the students under the Vermont Constitution, why don't we have a state education system rather than dividing it up into all these little subdivisions that create some good schools and some poor ones?
Paul Cielo, what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, it is under the Constitution. It is the state obligation. And Morris is right that the state could decide to have one large school district and have all the children in the state educated in that school district. I personally don't think that that's a good idea. And I think judging by the fact that we have these we still have these town or small school districts, that I think that appears to, at least to this point, have been the consensus. But the reason I say that is I think that we specifically, when we did Act 60 in 1997, we structured it so that these local school districts could remain in place but also have the resources they needed to run a good school. But what it does is it actually gives allows for the diversity of how you run a school, how you educate your children. And I personally think that the people in a community are the best advocates for the children in that community, and that that we get something qualitative improvement as a result of having communities come around to decide how to educate the children.
Let's get a quick call in from Deborah in Stockbridge. Hi, Deborah. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing? I'll try to make this real quick. I do live in a choice town, and I have two school-age kids that I tuition out. I think school choice for all is a great thing, as long as it's under the purview of our school boards. What happens in our town is almost all the kids are tuitioned out to one of these so-called independent schools, which are really exclusionary and private. You have to be accepted. You can get turned down. They don't take special needs kids, et cetera. And I don't think that my public tax dollars should be going to pay to some alternative school. So I believe what would solve this is if we enact charter school legislation that allows for these smaller schools but they're still under the purview of the Board of Education. Their budgets are approved. We have some local input on the curriculum, et cetera. Thank you.
All right. Rob, we're almost out of time, but what about this thought that, maybe if you're going to be in a tuitioning town, and you want to go to a private school, you should be able to go there. You don't have to apply and be accepted.
Well, I do think that most of the schools that I talk to, I do accept pretty much everybody. I know that they do accept special needs students. I'm sure that there are some schools that don't. I'm not sure which school she's talking about. At some point, you have to say, are there enough seats for the kids? You can't if 200 people want to go into a room that has 100 seats, you have to make some decisions.
Well, it's been a great discussion. Many thanks to our guests today, Paul Cielo and Rob Roper. We really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up next, we'll look at the new Farm Bill and how it will affect dairy farmers in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Congress has passed a new farm bill after resolving some major disagreements on the new dairy provisions in the bill. How will these changes affect dairy farmers in Vermont? With us now to take a look at this question is Amanda St. Pierre, a dairy farmer in Berkshire. She's also the head of the organization Dairy Farmers Working Together, a group that was very involved in the debate over the new farm bill. Amanda, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So before we discuss the specifics of the new dairy bill, you said to me earlier this week that it's really hard for you to imagine a dairy system that could be any worse than the one we have in place today. Could you explain to our listeners, what are the big problems in the existing system?
Well, pretty much the problems come in retrospect from my years in the dairy industry is the volatility in the price of the milk. So you pay your cost of production, but you have no say over what your ending sale price will be. That's decided by someone else. And oftentimes, and certainly in a three-year cyclical pattern, we dip well below the cost of production, and it has devastating effects on our Vermont farms.
Just so our listeners understand, how much of a swing in prices are you talking about? What would be an example of how high it might go or how low it might go?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're talking anywhere from getting paid $22 per hundredweight, and that's how a dairy farmer gets paid, is the pounds of milk you ship, going down sometimes to, you know, $16, while the cost of production could be anywhere from $19, you know, when you're selling milk at $16, so you got a $3 loss per hundredweight. And over time, it's very difficult to sustain that and regain it when it repeats the pattern every 3 years.
And then also one problem that happens is that when milk prices plummet, some dairy farmers increase their production. It's the only way they have to make more money.
Right. The only way some of our dairy farms in the state have to make money is sell the product of which they make, which is milk. So in times of a downturn, they actually make more milk because they need to increase their paycheck. And this isn't just a Vermont problem. This is what we found. It's a national problem. Our milk is priced on a national level and somewhat on a world market. So this was what we had in common with dairy farmers when we went around the country talking to them.
So your organization was instrumental in the drafting of a new approach that essentially had two parts, a price insurance plan and a supply management program. Let's start with the first part. How would the price insurance program help dairy farmers?
Well, the price insurance program was brought in later as a way of a compromise. And basically what that's supposed to do is that you can protect your margin on the majority of milk that you produce. And it was just it's another form of insurance. We have fire insurance. We have, you know, crop insurance. And this is another security net that we could have that we could protect however much of our milk that we wanted to protect in the margin of what it costs to make it. So if the price dipped, we could call on this insurance program to help. And with that was the other part was the dairy stabilization program, which was called supply management. It sent a signal to the dairy farmer to reduce when there was times of a low market situation. It gave a really direct signal based on the market to say, "Woe back on the production, and if you don't, then there'll be some penalties," which will make that even more clear to a dairy farmer, like this isn't worth doing. And the neat thing about that was that it was driven from the marketplace, and it was not funded by the government. And I guess that's one of the things that has amazed me with this farm bill is that they didn't want that. You know, we were looking for a way to, you know, make the government less liable for our industry, and they wouldn't see it that way. They actually went to more of a safety net, which the insurance program is now more funded by the government.
So you were surprised when House Speaker John Boehner referred to the supply management program as a Soviet-style dairy plan.
Absolutely, absolutely, because in essence, we weren't looking for money from the government. You know, that was one of the things early on in our discussions was we knew programs were coming to an end. Our country cannot continue to afford this type of system, and we don't want that. You know, we're business people, and we can understand that we need to drive our industry from the market. And so that was another real big, I think, milestone that we reached in the dairy industry to look at how do we support our industry without so much government help. And so when he came out and said it was a Soviet type of a program, I mean, I don't think he understood the program at all, or he was listening to maybe some lobbyists that like our milk to be very cheap and our milk products.
Do you think there are going to be some dairy farmers in Vermont who want to sign up for the price insurance program but feel that it's just another added expense that they can't afford?
You know, that's my concern. I think, and this was another thing that came out in our discussions, was we really need to educate after this farm bill, once the rules are written, because there's still a lot of things left unsaid. We really need to make an effort to educate our dairy industry, and like, these are the tools you have now in your toolbox. And then the dairy farmer has to make the best decision they can for their dairy farm. And there will be some farmers that will not choose to participate, and for their own reasons, but the best we can do is educate them and try to show them the options they have.
So the final compromise you ended up with is this. The price insurance plan is part of the new law, but the supply management component is gone. In its place is a two-tiered premium pricing plan where small farms would pay much lower premiums for their price insurance and larger farms would pay a higher premium. Is this going to work?
I think that they're hoping there's enough incentive there because you also can only protect a certain percentage of your milk on the larger farms. So they're hoping that there's enough incentive here that that can help contribute to the, you know, not having the real oversupply of milk. I don't know. I'm going to be cautiously optimistic. When we went into this, the early discussions was, look, what we have is broken. We need to come together and have discussions for the first time, and I really am excited about that, from coast to coast, and figure out what we have in common and figure out what we can compromise together and come up with some kind of solution. And there could have been many other solutions out there, but we went forth with the one that had the most support, and that was another huge milestone. I don't think it's ever been done on a dairy policy issue. So that being said, we're going to be optimistic that this compromise will have some tools we did not have before, and we can see some positive things from it. And if it's not what we need, then we need to continue the discussions and continue to look at changes. I don't feel like dairy policy is relevant when it takes 8 years to pass. I mean, that is a disappointment. We live in a fast-paced world. Our decisions on our dairy farm cannot wait 8 years. When we have something broken on our farm, we cannot wait 8 years to fix it. And we need to be creative about fixing it. And I think that that's up to us as farmers in this industry, that we need to keep pushing, keep educating consumers and our legislators and, you know, those that enjoy our food products that we make, that, you know, we deserve a forum where we can pass things that are relevant and timely.
Amanda St. Pierre, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
The Progressive Caucus called for a $15 minimum wage in Vermont. Staff members at Vermont Public Television called for board resignations. Solar subsidies for net metering received overwhelming support in the House. Vermont Technical College reported a growing deficit. And the Vermont Farm Show was held at the Champlain Valley Expo. These are some of the voices in the news this week.
Could any of you live on $8.73 an hour? And could you survive on $8.73 an hour if you were getting minimal or zero benefits? That is the reality if you live at the bottom of the chart.
We did not properly provide a notice following the meeting that such a session had been held by way of stating the group that met, the date of the meeting, and the reason for the meeting, the reason being a personnel matter. Had we done that, we wouldn't be in the middle of this current discussion.
If you see solar panels on your neighbor's roof or in a farm field, that's probably a net metering project.
We've had a saying for years in this system that one busload of students not showing up can make the difference between being in trouble and being in good shape.
I'm Martha Haggerty. I'm Chet Parsons' sister, who recruited me while they're having their sheep meeting. I'm sheep tending. They were born November 17th. Not planned. Sometimes nature gives you little prizes, which is great for the farm show because it was the right timing to bring babies. And everybody loves them.
You can find links to these stories at our website, vpr.net. That's our show for today. Monday on the program, to call someone a quitter is a serious insult, but sometimes leaving a bad situation is the best decision. We'll talk with Vermont writer Peg Streep about her new book, Mastering the Art of Quitting. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rickson Gary, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson and Devin Karambelis. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive director is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.